Thank you to Dr. James Blair, Preston Arrowweed, Christian Torres, Dr. Ali Sharbat, and the Bioneers Conference. And thank you to our listeners for joining us. Please connect with us on social media at EcoJustice Radio, SoCal350, and Wilder Utopia. And thank you to our listeners for joining us. Please connect with us on social media at EcoJustice Radio. If you like what you have heard and you want others to be informed, you know what to do. Subscribe and share the episodes. Project of SoCal 350. The show can be found on all major podcast apps and at ecojusticeradio.org. Executive producer is myself, Jack Eit, co-host Carrie Kim, and engineer and original music by Blake Quake Beats. And until next time, remember, the power is yours.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Hello, I'm Eugene Rashad. Join me every Saturday from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. for the best in jazz on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial.
But I dig, and I know you dig, because I got 4 requests for this thing already today. Strutting lightly.
That was KBOO volunteer disc jockey George Page. Page has been playing jazz and popular black music on KBOO for the past 12 years.
What I do to the audience I draw, hopefully, is to please them with all types of black music. Mostly what you can't hear as a rule on larger black-oriented stations in L.A. or San Francisco. I play a lot of blues and a lot of jazz. All of it's black-oriented, but it's not the cuts you're going to hear on the other jazz shows. It's not the cuts you're going to hear on other stations, because other stations just don't play jazz and blues in a black vein the way I do here.
1, 2, 3. May my voice be a strong and resonant vessel for love, for truth, for healing in this world.
Hello, my name is Emma Lugo, and today you're listening to Radio Zine here on KBOO Community Radio. Today we'll be having a panel discussion on free speech and education with 5 panelists, so stay tuned. The panel discussion is also interspersed with songs collected from the street choir that showed up to perform at our panel. So thanks so much, and stay tuned now for Radio Zine panel on free speech and education.
May my voice be a strong and resonant vessel for love, for truth, for healing in this world. May my voice be...
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Portland State University. Thank you for joining us tonight for this important conversation on free speech and education. My name is Emma Lugo. I'm a programmer at KBOO. This event is being recorded tonight for KBOO, and I'll be your moderator for this evening's panel. Across the United States, we are witnessing an increasingly urgent debate about the limits and protections of academic free speech. Universities, once seen as sanctuaries for open inquiry and diverse viewpoints, are facing growing pressure from both internal and external forces. Political polarization, financial dependencies, institutional risk management, and the rise of anticipatory obedience practices that constrain what can be said in the name of institutional reputation. Tonight, we'll explore how these dynamics are shaping classrooms, research agendas, and the broader culture of higher education itself. Our distinguished panelists come from a range of academic disciplines and institutional settings. Together, they bring firsthand insights into how free speech norms are changing on campuses and what this means for students and faculty, and how we might reclaim a spirit of intellectual courage in an age of self-censorship. Our speakers are Joel Benin, Marlene Eid, Susanna Kasouf, Jennifer Ruth, and Tammy Carpenter. I'll be introducing each one of them as they speak in that order. So we're going to start with Joel Benin. Joel is the Donald J. McLaughlin Professor of History Emeritus at Stanford University. He taught Middle East history at Stanford from 1983 to 2006 and 2008 to 2019. He also directed the Middle East Studies Program at American University in Cairo from 2006 to 2008. So,
okay, here we are. Thank you, Emma. Thank you all for coming. I'm going to speak about the Project ESTER, which was released in late 2024 and is a supplement to the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025, which is the broad framework for what the Trump administration has been doing since it came into office. Project ESTER is a self-proclaimed comprehensive strategy for dismantling the Palestine Solidarity Movement in the United States by deploying false claims of anti-Semitism and terrorism against it. It's entirely motivated by the unprecedented upsurge in support for Palestinian rights in the United States and globally after October 7th, 2023. How does it work? Step one, they invent a phony Hamas support network. So this is a quote from the report. America's virulently anti-Israel, anti-Zionist, and anti-American pro-Palestinian movement is part of a global Hamas support network supported by activists and funders dedicated to the destruction of capitalism and democracy. And the targets of Project ESTER are Students for Justice in Palestine, American Muslims for Palestine, Jewish Voice for Peace, and the Canadian-based Samidun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, and also the entities that Project ESTER authors think are its main financial supporters: the Westchester People's Action Coalition Foundation, which serves as a fiscal sponsor for many Middle East peace groups, and Arizona's Alliance for Global Justice, and the Tides Foundation, which funds Palestine Legal, Jewish Voice for Peace, and If Not Now, and it's on the Justice Project, the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, and others like that. How far off are the authors of Project ESTER? So this is Nora Khader, who is the executive director of Westpac, her remarks after the October 7th Hamas attack. On October 10th, she said, she decried Hamas's crimes against humanity and also Israel's crimes against humanity in response. She accused Israel of indiscriminate and deliberate bombing of civilians and also said the attack from Gaza has a context. So that's enough to get you right in the front lines of the Hamas support network, according to Project ESTER. So the goal is extirpating the influence of this putative Hamas support network from our society. Except that the Hamas support network doesn't exist. It's a fictional entity. No one in the Palestine Solidarity Movement uses the term. Middle East academics don't use the term. It's just something that they made up. Nonetheless, in late 2024, the Heritage Foundation established a national task force to combat anti-Semitism, whose mission is to lead a coalition to dismantle the infrastructure that sustains the Hamas support network and associated movements' anti-Semitic violence inside the United States of America within 12 to 24 months to restore equal protection under the law for all Americans. Step two, in addition to inventing a fictional entity, the Hamas support network, which it seeks to combat, Project Esther appropriates to itself the task of defending Jews for anti-Semitism, and the Heritage Foundation's National Task Force to Combat Anti-Semitism isn't made up primarily of Jews. Jewish Voice for Peace's Academic Advisory Council did some research on who these folk are, and it turns out that Project Esther was predominantly created by Christian nationalists, not Jews. Why is that? Because according to Project Esther, the American Jewish community has not demonstrated a unified resolve against the Hamas support network and its Hamas support organizations and their program of Jew hatred and American hatred. That is to say, most American Jews are liberals or progressives or, God help us, democratic socialists who support Zohran Mamdani. They don't share the views of the Heritage Foundation on anything. So to remedy the failures of the actual Jewish community, Christian nationalists have appropriated the mytho-historical story of Queen Esther, the heroine who saved the Jewish people from extermination in 4th century Persia before the Common Era. Jews commemorate her story during the spring holiday of Purim. Why is that? Christian nationalists view Esther as an ideal of womanhood, a woman who both engages in political action while remaining, in their interpretation, subservient to male authority. That's very important for Christian nationalists. Project Esther materials quote people like James Carafano, a Heritage Foundation expert who has posted multiple anti-Semitic conspiracy theories on his social media accounts. This broad claim of a sharp increase in anti-Semitism in the United States is based on dubious statistics produced by the Anti-Defamation League, ADL, which asserts that most expressions of support for Palestinian rights are anti-Semitic. In 2023, the Anti-Defamation League tabulated 8,873 anti-Semitic instances across the country, a 140% increase from 2022, and the highest number ever recorded. Between October 7th, 2023, and the end of the year, the ADL tabulated 5,204 incidents. So again, most of those incidents of anti-Semitism, according to the ADL, are actually some kind of expression of support for Palestinian rights. Project Esther does not engage with dismantling real anti-Semitism. The document does not mention the major anti-Semitic incidents of the first Trump term, the August 2017 Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, which featured marchers chanting Jews will not replace us and killing Heather Heyer in a car attack, beating black bystanders and directing a mob to burn down the town's only synagogue in downtown Charlottesville the next day. Does it mention the October 2018 Tree of Life shooting which is the most deadly attack on Jews in U.S. history, or other instances of violence or vitriol against Jews for being Jewish, which were committed by the far right. What does the Project Esther report address? Here's an example of their convoluted thinking. On November 7, 2023, the House of Representatives voted to censure Representative Rashida Tlaib for promoting false narratives regarding the October 7, 2023 Hamas attack and for calling for the destruction of the State of Israel. She didn't actually
actually say any of that. The resolution was adopted by a vote of 234 to 188. Of the 220 Republicans in the House at the time, 212 voted for censure. Of the 212 Democrats present in the House, only 22 voted for the resolution. So this got Project Esther people really upset. They were very disturbed that while there were only two Jewish Republicans in the House of Representatives and there were 25 Jewish Democrats, almost 12% of the Democratic representation, they're counting up the Jews, not a good thing, both Republicans voted in favor of censure compared to only 10 Democrats. In fact, more Jewish Democrats, 15, voted against censuring Representative Tlaib than the 12 who joined their Republican colleagues in voting for censure. So this is the problem. The Jews are not fighting anti-Semitism strongly enough. So Project Esther proposes criminalization and deportation of protesters and abridging fundamental constitutional rights like freedom of speech and the press. And President Trump has already implemented or threatened to implement half of Project Esther's demands in this respect. Universities have collaborated with the government's sweeping program of surveillance, and students have been disciplined for holding silent study-ins, banned from their own classrooms. They have had syllabi interrogated by administrators. Professors have been fired for sharing the words of Palestinian poets. I'll give you the details of all of this in the Q&A if you want. Minor infractions like postering have been met with expulsion and even felony charges, and schools are being investigated for allowing students to wear the keffiyeh and fly Palestinian flags. So that's just where we are now. It's going to get worse.
Thank you.
Be a strong and resonant vessel for love, for truth, for healing in this world. My voice be a strong and resonant vessel for love, for truth, for healing in this world.
I'd like to introduce our next speaker, Marlene Heath. Marlene is a graduate of Sorbonne University in Paris and of Portland State University here in Portland. She's presently a psychology faculty member of Portland Community College. Marlene is a Palestinian American born and reared in East Jerusalem, where she grew up under Israeli military occupation. She is a lifelong advocate of Palestinian human rights and a defender of social justice issues. Besides PCC, Marlene worked at PSU, where she taught psychology and women's studies. She worked as coordinator of Arab studies at the Middle East Studies Center. In 1990, Marlene traveled to the Gaza Strip and was one of the founding members of the Gaza Community Health Program in Gaza City.
Hi, everyone. One of the values of the global citizenship is to emphasize our humanity over anything else. What binds us to our global communities is our humanity and the search for social equity. We have principles and human rights that bind us together. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, or the UDHR, is a milestone document in the journey of humanity. This declaration was proclaimed by the United Nations General Assembly in Paris on December 10, 1948, as common standards of achievements for all peoples and all nations. It enshrined for the first time fundamental human rights as universally protected. The first concept of connectedness as humans to the global stage is through the virtue of global citizenship. This rebukes arguments that conflicts that are happening in a faraway place, in another far-off place, do not affect us. Using this prism, how do we judge the U.S. relations with Israel? Slide number three, please. First, let's look at the U.S. military funding of Israel. I'm sure most of you have heard this over and over again. The United States serves as Israel's great power patron, providing $3.8 billion a year to fortify Israel's military. Now, during the last 2 years of the genocide, what we can see is that both Presidents Biden and Trump supplied Israel with $17.8 billion in military aid, in addition to that $3.8 annual that they give continuously. So President Trump also notified Congress in September of an additional 6.5 million weapons transferred to Israel. So this U.S. funding is maintaining the Israeli military occupation of Gaza, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem. It continues fueling the genocide against the Palestinians in Gaza and the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. The U.S. is not only complicit in this genocide, but also is partnering with Israel in this genocide. The second part that we will be examining is the diplomatic relationships. The U.S. promotes the acceptance of Israel and uses its veto power. It used its veto power 6 times to block ceasefire resolutions proposed at the United Nations Security Council. Additionally, the U.S. has blocked a resolution that aimed at recognizing Palestine as a full member of the United Nations. In addition, the dehumanization of the Palestinians has been ongoing, as you know, for the last 100 years, that it became so normal to kill Palestinians, and the U.S. and other European countries have even attempted to normalize this genocide and the evil crimes committed by Israel in the last 2 years in Gaza. Not allowing an international media to cover what has transpired in Gaza is an affirmation of shielding Israel from the atrocities of the genocide it is committing, but also dehumanizing and erasing the profile of Palestinians as humans and reaffirming the double standard of the U.S. treatment of white versus brown and black people. Universities and colleges, whenever there is an invited speaker on Palestine at the university or college, the university administrators suddenly object by referencing balance, point of view, the other side. If a panel discussion is proposed by either students or faculty members, the use of the words such as balance, discourse, inclusion, and activity pop up, reflect nothing else but a lack of balance. Ignoring fully the lack of balance that have been exhibited in teaching about the issue for years, with the inherent bias of the ingrained Israeli narrative in the culture and curriculum. Either by knowledge or maybe ignorance, administrators, they escape from the situation which they are fully aware of, to justify their censoring of the Palestinian rights and to label the students and faculty as divisive and lacking balance. Balance is important. The Palestinians want balance, not the other way around. So yes, let's have the balance by starting to have speakers on Palestine and to teach about Palestine, and not only advocate for the Israeli narrative that has been the staple of the dominant culture and educational system. To further emphasize the imbalance when it comes to Palestine, it is difficult to equate an oppressor and an oppressed, an occupier and an occupied, a master and a slave. The military power of the State of Israel, with the overwhelming power of weaponry, technology, drones, unprecedented power of explosives, as you have heard of the tons over Gaza, of the latest weapons and artillery, opposite to a people resisting for their mere existence. From 1948 Nakba, which my grandparents and parents lived, to the 1967 war that I have lived under Israeli occupation in East Jerusalem, and now the genocide that my children and the whole world is witnessing live on TV and social media. Through all this history, the main constant that you could see is the Israeli violence and dominance. To go back to the bias ingrained in the academic institutions, you would surmise that universities that have a Middle East Studies department, like PSU, would have a semi-decent dabbling in a balanced scholarly debate about issues like the genocide in Gaza, the assault on the West Bank, Israeli assault on Iran, Lebanon, Syria, and most recently on Qatar, the intermediary negotiator. Unfortunately, none of that invoked panel discussions or speakers at PSU. I wonder which Middle East are they studying? At the college and university levels, conflating anti-Semitism with the criticism of Israel, by conflating anti-Semitism, what we have is that universities are diverting the issue and the conversation from Israel violating Palestinian human rights towards individual motivations. In essence, attempting to silence and ignore the genocide and the ethnic cleansing and sever any relationship to the human rights connectedness. By accepting the IRA definition of anti-Semitism in any institution, and especially in institutions of higher education, we are also diluting the meaning of anti-Semitism, right, reducing the importance of the term and the weaponizing in the face of any recognition of Palestinian human rights. These actions chill protected speech and diverts the focus from real anti-Semitism and absolves Israel from any accountability in this genocide. Governments are cracking down on Palestinian human rights activists, and this is slide number 7. This is not new. It happened in the US before. Some of you might remember. It's a deja vu for me and for people who have seen it. There's the case of the LA-8. The government is trying to deport Palestinian human rights activists and their allies for protesting on campuses because the government does not agree with their political views. I do have a slide here that compares the two, Mahmoud Khalil and what the government has done to him, and a comparison with what happened to the LA-8 in 1987. So this is 38 years later. We're seeing things happen over and over again. Universities and colleges need to highlight and emphasize the importance of academic freedom and freedom of speech. There needs not be exceptions to free speech on college campuses. Our students should not fear retaliation, be punished, or face crackdowns and repression by college administrators and by the police for supporting Palestinian rights and for criticizing the state of Israel. Faculty and students and others are exercising their rights and defending their freedom of speech by refusing to be intimidated when speaking about Palestine. Palestine should not be the exception. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I'm gonna tell you, fascists, you sure might be surprised. There's people in this world and we're getting organized. You're bound to lose, you fascists, bound to lose. All you fascists, bound to lose. All you fascists, bound to lose. Bound to lose. You fascists bound to lose, you bound to lose, you fascists bound to lose. There's people from every nation marching side by side. They're marching across the fields where a million fascists died. You're bound to lose, you fascists bound to lose.
Susanna Kassou.
Prince, who teaches social studies at Grant High School and Portland Public Schools. She's a regular contributor to Rethinking Schools and the Zen Education Project, including co-editing the recent Rethinking Schools book, Teaching Palestine, and the upcoming Rethinking Schools book, Teaching Environmental Justice. She regularly presents at education conferences focused on social and climate justice, in addition to her work as an educator. Kasouf is a committed activist who co-founded the youth-led climate justice organization, Sunrise Movement PDX. She's a 2024-26 Prentice Tourney Fellow.
Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for having me here. Thank you so much to the speakers so far. I'm going to take a lot of what they said and kind of just boil it down to my own personal experience. You can go to the next slide. So I was hired as a teacher in Portland Public Schools in 2020. And so I'm sure you remember that was the height of COVID. So this was the online year. But it was also the height of, you know, one of the biggest movements for racial justice that I've ever witnessed in my life. And PPS had a lot of really lofty rhetoric in support of racial and social justice. They had the Civic Engagement and Unrest Toolkit. You can go to the next slide. They had this racial equity and social justice lens, which they had started before 2020, but they updated during this time. Next slide. And there's this beautiful quote in that lens document that says, "We believe in the fundamental right to human dignity, and that generating an equitable world requires an educational system that intentionally disrupts and builds leaders to disrupt systems of oppression." Ooh. Beautiful, right? Mm-hmm. And I really took that to heart as an educator. And in a lot of ways, in my first 4 years of teaching for PPS, I was really supported in this. I taught a class called Ninth Grade Inquiry, which had really sort of murky boundaries around the curriculum. And in many ways, it became like a social justice class. I taught a unit I developed on power, identity, and culture. We talked about the war on drugs, institutional racism. We talked about the Congo. We talked about gender. We talked about transgender rights, etc. It's a beautiful class. Until, you know, October 7th, 2023. And then all of a sudden, I and my students are witnessing day after day after day on our phones some of the most horrific things we will ever see in our lives. I'm sure everybody in this room has images in their mind that they just won't be able to get out. You know, especially I'm a new mom now, and the images of the children, it's just, it's unbearable. And we know that if anyone is going to be remotely serious about disrupting systems of oppression, we cannot ignore what is happening in Gaza. And so it was my responsibility to teach about what was happening in Gaza. And that's what I did. With the help of my wonderful mentor, Bill Bigelow, I developed a unit on Palestine and Israel. And I'm going to talk about kind of one thing that happened. So what's the next slide? Oh yeah, I guess I'll say the first thing I did is, before I started teaching the unit, I put up my posters in the hallways. I've got my ceasefire posters. You might even notice here there's a sign that says, "Release the hostages." I believe in human rights for all people, of course. Next slide. And then, yeah, so this book is for sale. You can get it today over there. And one of the lessons in the book was a lesson that Bill developed that he tried out in my own classroom. And I wish I had so much more time to explain so much about this lesson, because it's wonderful. But essentially, it's a role play. So there are 17 different roles that are intended to teach students about the birth of Zionism. So the time period in this role play is like 1882 with the first Zionist conference in Vienna, and it goes till 1922 when the League of Nations gives Palestine to Great Britain in the British Mandate for Palestine. And so in these 17 different roles, students meet 17 different perspectives when it comes to Zionism. So you have people like Theodor Herzl, the founder of Zionism. You have people like Joseph Peretz, who was a young Jewish boy who escaped pogroms in Russia and came to Palestine. And then you also have people who were supportive of Zionism who were anti-Semitic, like Lord Balfour from the British Empire, who in many ways supported the Zionist movement because he didn't want Jewish refugees coming to Great Britain, and he called them undesirable immigrants. And of course, you know, to have a strategic ally in this important region of the world. And then in the role, of course, there are people who are critical of Zionism, Palestinians who are being evicted from their land, people who are fighting back against Zionism, but also many Jews who were critical of Zionism. Zionism was at first a very fringe movement in the Jewish community. There are Jewish folks like Patty Kramer of the Bund in Russia who really believe that Jews should be able to be safe wherever they live. They shouldn't have to go to a new country in Palestine. Or people like Yosef Castel, whose family was a Sephardic Jew, whose family had lived in Palestine since 1492 when his family was evicted from Spain, who had lived in general harmony with Arab, Palestinians, Muslims, Christians for centuries and didn't think it was a good idea to now have a Jewish country for Jews and an Arab country for Arabs, but rather we should continue to coexist peacefully. So students, they meet all these folks, they have this role play, they get all these different perspectives. Like, no one could argue that they're just getting one perspective here. There's 17 different perspectives. They come together. And then they kind of decide in small groups, like, who or what is at the root of the violence that we see today. Because if you turn on pretty much any media, who is blamed for the violence that we see in Gaza? Somebody call it out.
Hamas,
right? They start the clock on October 7th. So this asks us to go way, way back in time. Go to the next slide. So students, one thing I regret is I did not document this with photos better. I wish I had, but I have some. So students came up with so many brilliant ideas. You know, Theodor Herzl is at the core of this. The most common one was anti-Semitism is at the core of this, because that's what leads to Zionism and all the pogroms in Russia and Jews not being able to be safe. Someone, you know, we said there was the British Empire, the Ottoman Empire, the Balfour Declaration, Lord Balfour. I love this one, the belief that no one can coexist equally. That was beautiful. Okay, all these different things are at the core of this. And there were, you know, let's say I have 150 students, so there were about 75 of these posters. And like I did with all posters that my students make, I hung these in the hallway outside my classroom. In the spring, the Students for Justice in Palestine, or they, as they call themselves, Students for Peace in PPS, organized a walkout. And this got many pro-Israel families very, very upset. And one of the families was an alumni at Grant and saw these posters. And I had a friend who was actually in Jewish Voice for Peace, who was kind of like a spy in the Jewish Federation of Greater Portland meeting when they were talking about these posters. And then the Jewish Federation of Greater Portland organized a massive campaign, probably thousands of calls to my school district and my school, demanding that these posters get taken down, demanding that my posters get taken down, etc. And actually, I want to say, you've got to kind of admire their organizing. They're pretty organized. And we are wanting to be just as organized. So these are the flyers that are around the room that has us set up our own kind of legal, what they call, Palestinian Education Defense Network. So we can do thousands of calls to protect Palestinian educators and educators who are teaching about this. But okay. Creators, producers.
I'm one of the directors.
Oh, you're the one of the directors.
Marlene was
the producer. Wonderful. So who's heard of this idea of like the Palestine exception, right? Like you can talk about all these social justice things, but not Palestine. And of course I had that feeling while this was happening, but I also had this strong feeling that this wasn't just an exception, it was a wedge.
Definitely.
That this is the way that all of these right-wing groups who are trying to take down social justice education are getting their foot in the door of districts, even like Portland Public Schools, who had been so vehemently against what they were trying to do. And it's been working. You can go to the next slide. So here is a map where we see anti-CRT measures being proposed and passed all around the country. Next slide. And where we see book bans in public libraries and in schools. And this is an article from the New York Times just the other day about how California is now backtracking on requiring ethnic studies based on a legal battle mounted by some Jewish groups saying that the way that ethnic studies dealt with Israel was anti-Semitic. Go to the next slide. And then at my own school, the next fall, we started with this new administrative directive, which says, no teachers can no longer have political or personal displays. Now, do you think that actually reinforced for anything other than Palestine? Mm-hmm. Reinforced? No, of course not. But at any point, could a parent come and say, that pride flag is offending me and my religion? Yeah, there's an administrative directive now. Can they come and say that immigrants are welcome here, sign is political, you have to take it down? Right, yeah. Let's go to the next slide. And I'm going to try to give PPS the benefit of the doubt, because they just redid their website. But as of when I was preparing for this speech 2 days ago, the racial equity lens is gone, that toolkit. And instead there's this kind of jargony thing about data, but no strong language interrupting institutions of oppression. And that next slide, this civic engagement and arrest toolkit is gone. It's no longer accessible on the website. Next. And then actually the only place I could find them, even though I had been using them when this was all happening, was on this right-wing group, Parents Defending Education. This is the same right-wing group that has put in a freedom of information request for all of my emails. And I just want to point out one thing they say. I'm sorry, no, I'm almost done. I'm going to wrap up real quick. But they said, we fight indoctrination in classrooms and on campuses to promote the reestablishment of quality, non-political education for all students. These are the people who want students every day to start the day, stand up, put your hand over your heart, look at a flag, and say, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America. What could be more indoctrinating than that? They try to pretend that we are the ones with ideology when we know that they are the ones with ideology. Next slide. So let's skip this. So I just want to say, this moment is calling on us to be in solidarity with one another in a way that we never have before. The reason that these groups are targeting education so much is because they know that if we teach the truth, we are going to tell kids example after example after example in history where people came together, even in the face of tyrants, to stand up for what is right, and sometimes won. And I just really hope that these attacks on us will make us stop attacking one another, come together in true solidarity across identity, across issue, even across belief, with people that we don't believe in everything with, to really mount a resistance to what is happening. Sorry, I went over. Thank you.
All you fascists bound to lose, all you fascists bound to lose, bound to lose, all you fascists bound to lose, you bound to lose, you fascists bound to lose. Life's race cannot stop us, that's one thing that we know. Your unmarked fans and tear gas and fascist grip must go, you're bound to lose. You fascists bound to lose. All you fascists bound to lose. All you fascists bound to lose. Bound to lose. All you fascists bound to lose. You bound to lose. You fascists bound to lose. All you fascists bound to lose. All you fascists bound to lose, all you fascists bound to lose, you bound to lose, you fascists bound to lose.
Woo. Our next speaker is Jennifer Ruth. Jennifer Ruth is a professor in the School of Film at Portland State University. She writes about academic freedom and higher education in outlets such as The New Republic, Truthout, Academy.
Okay, so I want to say a few things about some random things, and then I have a focus on three things that I think are relatively obscured either in the mainstream media, or they're just hard to kind of put your finger on, even if you're one of the most informed people. And of course, higher education, the culture wars is of course a plank for the MAGA, and they rode it to power. So it's in all the press, but there's some things that are kind of hard to figure out that I'm going to get to. But I also want to mention two things that you all have made me think of. I think about the question of a multi-ethnic state democracy rather than an ethno-nationalist state, and the idea that every state has a obligation to keep its citizenry safe. Mm-hmm. So in, whether you consider them in diaspora or you don't consider them in diaspora. And I think about the bipartisan quality of the Palestine exception. I think about Biden saying in a public speech that if Israel didn't exist, not a Jew would be safe in the world, mm-hmm. almost guaranteed. As he's the president of the United States with an obligation to make sure that they're safe. And then I think with Trump, it's just hard to avoid thinking about Marx saying that history repeats first as tragedy, then as farce. Mm-hmm. The farce is just as tragic, though. I mean, I think about the Leni Riefenstahl. I teach film, mm-hmm. and so I can't help but think about Leni Riefenstahl's Triumph of the Will. Those of you who are familiar with it, she opens with, it's about the Nuremberg rally, the National Socialism, the Nazis, and you got all that kind of fascist aesthetics that Susan Sontag has written about in terms of like the great leader and all the individuals being subsumed. But it starts with a plane going across the motherland or the fatherland, and it sort of identifies this kind of omniscient, bird's eye perspective with Hitler. And then, how many of you saw the plane of Trump shitting on the No Kings rally? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's so profoundly demoralizing and terrifying on every level, from top all the way through. And I will try to speak to PSU in particular because it needs to be made personal. It needs to be made local. And one of the things that I would say about PSU in particular is that the Jewish Federation of Greater Portland has had an unbelievable amount of leverage and power and influence over this administration. And it's through the attempts to appease them that we get suppressed and we get the consequences for our free speech and academic freedom. So to give you an example, Jewish Federation of Greater Portland was helping students. There was a Gareed case that they recruiting students and their families to file lawsuits against universities and helping to support and fund those lawsuits. So every campus administrator in the Greater Portland area was desperate to show them that we're working hard to contain so-called anti-Semitism, right? When, again, you think of those congressional hearings with Elise Stefanik and Virginia Fox. Will you discipline someone for calling for genocide? Nobody called for genocide. They called for an end to genocide. But so the Jewish Federation of Greater Portland, and we have board members who is affiliated with Jewish Federation. And one of the things that's been exposed in the last few years about the lack of genuine academic freedom, genuine shared governance and higher education, one of the things that has been exposed is the fact that by the bylaws of colleges and universities across the country, public, private, rural, urban, big, small, board members have extraordinary power if they choose to try, if they become politically activated in some way, which they have, you know, starting with the RUFO New College Board, but everywhere. Mark Rowan, University of Pennsylvania, he's on the board, and he was part of designing the compact that, thank God, and UPenn, and around, again, so you had a set of politically activated board members pre-10/7 who didn't like Black Lives Matter, didn't like transgender issues, et cetera, et cetera. And then after 10/7, there was another set of board members who felt like, who were either sincerely buying what the mainstream media was selling, that anti-Semitism is rampant on college campuses, or, you know, had their own opportunistic relationship to what was going on. All right, so in our campus was absolutely no different. And what is, I think is important to know is that the mainstream media was, of course, focused on the elite colleges. This happened everywhere. One thing, I'm working on the documentary, The Palestine Exception, the campuses that we look at are Portland State, Hunter College in New York. We look a little bit at UCLA, but Hunter and Portland State and Cal Poly Humboldt and some, this happened everywhere, and you wouldn't know that. The suppression of the support for Palestine on the level of the people who don't have power mm-hmm. has been so suppressed by our media mm-hmm. and the narratives distracted. Narratives about safety for and anti-Semitism for Jewish students and the narratives about the elite have distracted us from this really amazing and powerful movement. Are the three things that, because I did not time myself, so I'm a little worried. So I have 2 minutes? Okay, so really, that's okay, because it's very specific three things that I wanted to say, because I think for most people it's murky. One is that thank God they're all rejecting the compact. That doesn't change the fact that we still have them using Title VI and DEI investigations to force settlements with different universities. And they can continue to do that with every university if they want. So we've got Brown has made a settlement, Columbia's made a settlement, and four or five of them, Harvard is still pending, UCLA looks like they're working towards a settlement that's obscene. We've got these settlements. What I want to point out to you, because they're often based on Title VI investigations, right? I'm going to leave off the DEI questions about what's essentially they're trying to say reverse racism, right? Racism against white people. We'll leave that off for in the interest of time and stick with Title VI. Title VI investigations were done by the Department of Ed without there ever being a revoking of federal funding up until the Trump administration. Wow. And under the Trump administration, it's not primarily the Department of Ed that's even doing the investigations. It's a joint DHHS, Department of Health and Human Services, Department of Justice, and Department of Education. 7 of the 11, I don't know, I could be slightly off on the numbers, but the majority of the local civil rights centers across the country that are run through the Department of Education have been closed. They were trying to get rid of the Department of Education altogether. So they have an extremely reduced workforce. They have brought in people, political appointees, not long-term civil servants. They brought in political appointees from some of the other agencies, federal agencies, to try to mount these things. They are not actually having investigations. There is none of the protocols and mechanisms that went into actual investigations of Title VI by civil rights lawyers working for the Department of Education in the past. It's the threat of the investigation and the fact that you can withhold federal funding, you can try to use the threat of withholding or actually withholding federal funding, and that investigations take a long time and legal challenges take a long time. Mm-hmm. And then lastly, I just want to, yeah, I got to stop.
And Tammy Carpenter has been a director of the Beaverton School District School Board since July 2023. Tammy earned her bachelor's degree in engineering from Washington University in St. Louis in 1993. After a short career as an engineer, she matriculated to the University of Chicago, where she earned a medical degree in 2003. Tammy is an anesthesiologist in the Portland community. She served on the board of directors of her multi-hospital anesthesia practice. She's also been a leader within the Oregon Society of Anesthesiologists and the American Society of Anesthesiologists.
Thank you. My brain works better when I'm standing. Okay. Plus, you can see my slide. So, thank you. I'm an anesthesiologist and educator, school board member. I'm going to talk a little bit about the physician part of this first. Next slide, please. Across the world, we all take the Hippocratic Oath. Most of us have this idea of the ancient one in our minds, but really, it's been updated, and there's no evidence of it actually ever said, first do no harm. But this is the section I just wanted to highlight. I will remember that I remain a member of society with special obligations to all of my fellow human beings. Wow. Mm-hmm. So I just question, we do have elected physicians even here in the state. And so mm-hmm. I just wonder if they remember this and if they think it applies mm-hmm. to the rest of their lives. Next slide, please. So I first spoke out on October 17th, and I'm showing social media because it's sort of the avenue that I was attacked with. October 17th, they bombed Al-Shifa Hospital. And when I say they, Israel bombed Al-Shifa Hospital. That was controversial at the time to say that, but we all knew at the time. I think everyone in this room knew at the time. And we can talk about the excuses, but we knew that was what was happening. And so I spoke out then, and I continue to speak out ever since. The one thing that, again, speaking as a physician, that really impacted me during this was one time fairly early in the genocide, there was a young nephrologist who had been on with Amy Goodman several times, and then one morning Amy Goodman said that he was dead. Oh. He had been killed. Mm-hmm. And I remember going to work and speaking with a friend of mine, and I wasn't really sure where he was from, but thought maybe he was Arab, and he was from Jordan, and his wife is Palestinian, and I was saying, you know, how heartbreaking it was to hear about this death of this young nephrologist. He said, I know him, we were trained together.
Aww.
And so there's, you know, there is this really connectedness that I have felt with this. And then later on in the genocide when, and I know we all saw this, Dr. Abu Safiya, walked out of his hospital into the tank and hasn't been seen since. And so there is a understanding. I learned new words during the genocide, the word medicide, the word scholasticide. And so we know that has happened. And those are, you know, I love words. Did not ever want to learn those words. Next slide, please. And so, again, I have consistently shown up both like on social media for whatever that's worth, gone to rallies, spoken at rallies, even on the dais of my public meetings. There are times that, again, had to couch things and say, you know, we want the return of the hostages, we want the release of the prisoners, we want. So, so as weak as that was, it was too much. And so there was a point early on when, oh, next slide, please. The JVP petition, I don't know if you guys remember this, from November of 2023 or so, a bunch of electeds in Oregon signed on. I think it really scared the Jewish Federation that four of the seven Beaverton School Board members signed it. And so when they came to each of us and said, here's when you can meet with us, I didn't meet with them, still haven't met with them. One of my colleagues did unsign, but anyway, so that generated, they're well coordinated. At the time, I wouldn't have necessarily known it was JFED, but you know, you can look back and say, calls to my employer, calls to the school district, the social media attacks on my employer and the school district on me. Someone got my phone number, you know, that's okay. Next slide, please. And then in May of this year, they were very much more organized. And so 13 formal complaints came to the school district alleging bias. And it was, they were related. I think what set them off was my post about NAPRA. And that was very, very hurtful for them to see me saying that on my social media. Not on the dais, but on my social media. And so my colleagues on the school board voted to formally investigate me. So they brought in an outside investigator. You know, real uncomfortable. For God's sake, with this, Emma. This is going to be on Kibu. My disclosures. I am speaking as myself, not as a school board representative. I say that because one of the knocks against me by the investigator was that I was on a Kibu interview, and I didn't say that I was only representing my view. So that disclosure aside. So,
I don't represent Portland State.
Right, none of us are representing any of our organizations. I know. I just, that's still kind of like raw for me. So, anyway, so formal complaints were filed. And then, next slide, please. So, I don't think the trick is working as well as it used to. I don't know if I want to say it doesn't work anymore, but it doesn't work as well. And so, for me, what happened when my colleagues voted to investigate me was, the community responded, the community organizations responded. Next slide, please. We had the DSA, Jewish Voice for Priests. I know this, I'm not very good at slides. This is literally the first slide deck I've ever made. I'm a physician, I work with my hands, I don't do this. American Council for Palestine, Jewish Palestinian Alliance for Oregon, there may have been others. They just showed up.
Aww.
It was beautiful. So 150, yay, I know. Thank you, because I know some of you in here were there, anywhere. And so 150 people came, had a rally outside, brought the energy inside to our school board meeting. And so what that did is they gave me a platform, right? They gave us a platform. So we had a rally about Gaza. We had a rally about free speech. And you know, again, the trick doesn't work as well. So we used that opportunity to uplift the cause to end, you know, our calls, our pleas to end the genocide. So so that's you know, that's my saga. Like it started again. Honestly, school board meeting this month, 3 weeks ago, they showed up again. They sat up here and gave public comments. And you can't respond. I don't know if any of you have been to any kind of public meeting like that, but as an elected, I sit there and I listen to them call me anti-Semitic. And it's hard, it's fine, but it's fine, you know. I didn't melt, I didn't. But what it did, again, is it gave me the opportunity. At the end of that meeting, when I get to do my comments, I get to say things like, talking about the country that is committing a genocide is not anti-Semitic. Perfect. Talking about the fact that we have Palestinian families in our district that have lost hundreds of family members is not anti-Semitic. I said this to the now empty room, which is, you know, how these things work. But I would not have said that had they not given me the platform.
Yeah.
So I would never thank them for that. It's hard. And they, in some ways, create the opportunity, or at least we can seize the opportunity that is given to us. So that's my sad story, but you know, turned it into some really great opportunities. I'm going to be really short. Also, I apologize. I've never made slides. When I asked Canva, I was like, give me a Palestine thing. This is the closest thing. So thank you all.
Great job.
Thank you. You've been listening to Radio Zion here on KBOO Community Radio. That was a panel on free speech and education. Thanks so much for listening to KBOO.
Raising our voices.
Raising our voices.
Louder each time.
Louder each time.
People.
People.
Power.
Power. We demand free Palestine.
Raising our voices,
raising our voices,
louder each time,
louder each time.